The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on Twitter to join these conversations live. And check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets. And now, on to our Lead Lag Live discussion hosted by Michael Guyad. My name is Michael Guyad, publisher of the Lead Lag Report. Joining me for the hour is Mr. Mark Chaykin, who is known for creating some signals, which we'll talk about. But Mark, for those who are not familiar with your name, introduce yourself. Who are you? How'd you get involved, interested in markets? And what are you doing with Chaykin Analytics?
I got registered as a stockbroker, Michael, the day the bear market of 1966 ended, October 7th. Please don't do the math. I've been doing this a long time. And I was with a great firm at their main office at 14 Wall Street, Shearson Hamel. Terrific fundamental research. I got to know the analysts. And every day looked like an uptick until 1969, when the first bear market that I had lived through as a stockbroker slash advisor surfaced. And it was nasty. And what I learned was that fundamental analysts put their feet in cement. And if they like a stock at 100, they'll double down at 80 and then just bet the ranch at 60. And typically at about 20 bucks, they threw in the towel and said, you got to get out. So I realized pretty early on that I needed something else to protect client assets and to sleep well during bear markets. So that started a lifelong research project into technical analysis. And I started out with relative strength. And I still believe that relative strength is the key to making money in the stock market, along with industry group strength. And then in the late 70s, when PCs first cropped up, actually it was the Apple II, I started building technical indicators. And based on the work that Larry Williams had done, I created the Chaykin Oscillator, which is now morphed into Chaykin Money Flow. So for me, making money in the markets starts with two technical indicators: relative strength, how is the stock performing relative to the market, and money flow to see what the smart money is doing. And we use a 21-day moving average of money flow, and it's an oscillator, so it fluctuates around a zero line. But what I learned early in my career is that fundamentals drive the market, but technicals drive the market to extremes. In other words, momentum and trend and volume are really critical. So for me, making money in the stock market has always been combining fundamentals with technicals.
Yeah, you take me back to a one time I was in the Bloomberg headquarters. I was going to do a Bloomberg segment many, many years ago. And I was talking to some guy who was a fundamental analyst. And he was joking about how he had some price target and that the internal speak at his firm was that if the price target is hit, all you got to do is then increase the price target. So I share your kind of cynicism around fundamentals. And that's what a lot of the sort of old school technicians would argue, right? That the fundamentals lag price. Do you think that that lag, though, has shortened over time, that those that are looking at stock prices, looking at charts, that's a closer correlation to fundamentals than before because information moves so much quicker?
Well, that's interesting, because where I really was able to pull this together was when I was at Drexel Burnham in the early to late 80s. And Drexel had a quantitative database called DAIS, and a guy named George Douglas created it. There were only two quantitative databases on Wall Street at the time. One was at Morgan Stanley and the other was at Drexel. And so I got access as a retail stockbroker to the database and started doing research combining fundamentals and technicals. And George Douglas was a pioneer in something called earnings surprise and earnings estimate revision. And back then, he proposed the idea that when a company beats analyst estimates or misses, that there's a lag effect of anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks before the rest of Wall Street sort of catches on and upgrades their estimates. And so we have a 20-factor model called the Power Gauge. You asked what we were doing at Chaikin Analytics. And three of the 20 factors in the model are based on earnings estimates and analyst revision. So when a company reports a positive earnings surprise, in spite of the fact that there's almost instant access to information, stocks like TipRanks, and there was another publicly accessible site that predicted earnings and picked up on surprises, that lag effect still works. It takes time for analysts to change their targets, to change their earnings estimates, and filter into the market. So back then, what I learned, and George Douglas actually did the research, is that analyst estimate revisions are the single biggest short-term driver of stock prices. And we're talking about 1983, 40 years ago, still true today. If you look at companies that have reported better than expected earnings, beat on the top line, and also raise guidance, those stocks are going to outperform. They may pull back a bit if they get overextended, but these are the stocks where that lag effect still takes place. And also, they're more likely to report a positive earnings surprise the next quarter because they tend to come in bunches. When I started talking about this on webinars, I was living in New York City, and I said, earnings surprises are like cockroaches. There's never just one of them. And that's as true today as it was in the mid-90s. So I don't think that instantaneous access to information has really changed the playing field at all.
And I think that another term for that would be the post-earnings announcement drift, right? Which is you have a earnings that are better than estimated, you have a gap, and then there's underreaction that continues to move higher. Are there certain sectors or industries where that's more likely to occur? In other words, where there's more likely to be surprises because of the nature of the industry or the sector?
That's an interesting question. I'd never thought about it that way. And there may be an effect like that. Another way to sort of phrase the question is there an alpha dog in every industry group or sector? And there clearly is. So if you look at Lennar, they tend to report earnings in the home building space before D.R. Horton. It used to be that you could get a sort of a tell on Apple by looking at what some of their suppliers reported. And then supposedly Apple said to their suppliers, we don't want your reporting before we do. So companies like Skyworks or some of the semiconductor chip manufacturers that make the chips that go into the iPhone were sort of a great way to tell what the Apple earnings were going to be, because if they beat estimates, Cirrus Logic and Skyworks being two examples that I've used over the years, you could get a good tell on what Apple was going to do. But I think Apple told them, don't report before we do. It's you're front-running our earnings report. Well, I think one thing that the rule change has sort of engendered is caution on the part of CFOs in terms of setting the bar low. And Jim Cramer said something really smart about 5 years ago. He said, don't trade a stock after hours until the CFO has gotten on the earnings call, because that's the guy who's signing off on that. And he's the one who's liable if there's any misstatements. But, you know, I think we tend to overthink things. People get hung up on high frequency trading. Now there's 0 day expiring options. I just believe in keeping it simple. And that's why I created this 20-factor model that we call the Chaikin Power Gauge rating. The market has different constituents with varying styles and time horizons. And they were clients of mine in an institutional brokerage firm that I started when I left Drexel Burnham in 19 87 and was fortunate enough to sell to the internet trading arm of Reuters back in 1992. I had clients like the value investors in the Mid-Atlantic region, Delaware Management stands out, T. Rowe Price is a growth investor, the hedge funds in New York like Soros back then, Steinhardt and Paul Tudor Jones, and then the growth investors up in Boston, and with a lot of people in between. They have different styles and different time horizons. And you have to have some way to take into account that sort of blend of inputs that go into the day-to-day trading. And I just think people get too hung up on, you know, the Fed du jour and start railing against it and miss opportunities. I mean, the bottom line is that, for instance, high-frequency trading can create great opportunities if you've got a good way to filter down the universe of stocks into 10 or 20 stocks that you watch every day looking for buying or selling opportunities. You know, that's really interesting because that's one of the bullet points I wrote down before the call. You know, they've created, especially with the cap-weighted ETFs like SPY and QQQ, they've created an underlying demand when money is flowing in. Now, interestingly, hopefully we can get back to this in a bit when we talk about my market view, $31 billion has come out of equity mutual funds and ETFs since the beginning of the year. And that creates pressure on the mega cap stocks that have an outsized weighting in those indices. And right now, let's just look at the S&P for simplicity's sake. I'm bullish on the market, but I think that someone who wants index exposure in the large cap space should be buying the equal weighted S&P, the RSP, instead of the SPY, which is cap weighted. Same is true in the consumer discretionary space. Our power gauge rating, and we have a power gauge rating for ETFs that actually combines fundamentals and technicals, so it's unique. The power gauge rating for the XLY, the consumer discretionary cap-weighted ETF, is neutral. And that ETF is trading about 11% below its high in August. The power gauge rating for the RCD, which is the equal weighted consumer discretionary, has actually exceeded the August peak by 7% because it's not being weighed down by Amazon. So I think when you talk ETFs, you have to distinguish, and of course, SPY and QQQ are the largest ETFs in terms of both size and volume, and they're capitalization weighted. So there's good, there's bad, and there's ugly in ETFs. Ugly being, you know, sad thing that happened to all the people who invested in the ARK funds in the last 18 to 24 months. But in general, I love ETFs. They're a great way to get exposure. And also, if you've got an ETF that has a bullish rating in our model, which means that the underlying stocks have a preponderance of stocks with a bullish fundamental power gauge rating, you can then drill down on an ETF that's performing well, see which stocks have the best ratings. In our model, we look at the power gauge, and then sort of invest in the best of the best. You can create your own mini hedge fund to outperform an ETF that's positioned bullishly, as most ETFs are right now.
I am curious. I'll go back to you, Weisskopf, for a second, and we'll get into the current market views. But I'm curious, Mark, on a lot of what you're doing, you know, for, as I understand it, is very much company specific. And really, since quantitative easing 3 and zero interest rate policy, you can argue that a lot of co-movement increased. It became much more about macro as opposed to micro, right? Much more top down than bottom up. Am I wrong in thinking that the last decade's been challenging relative to prior periods because of the unusual behavior of the Federal Reserve with its monetary policy impacting the results of what would usually be predictors of individual stock market movement? And if I'm not wrong on that, the assumption then would be that going forward, things are going to normalize to the pre-2013 era.
Well, I think you're right. Actually, it's more like a barbell. I have personally always used the top-down approach. Starting, let's forget the market because nobody can really call the market. consistently over time, at least. And I've been doing it since 1967. But you can identify the strongest sectors based on, well, we used to do price movement, but now we do price volume and fundamentals, and more particularly drill down to the best industry groups. And so that has worked well through all kinds of markets. My original guru in relative strength was a guy named George Chestnut, who started doing this all by hand at his kitchen table in Larchmont, New York, and then Greenwich, Connecticut in the 1950s. And he had a newsletter that I invested in and a mutual fund, American Investors, which was wildly successful in the 50s and 60s. And George just did relative strength of industry groups, then zeroed in on the best stocks in those industry groups. And that's sort of gave me the inspiration early on to follow relative strength. That hasn't changed. That works day in and day out. But I do think we're heading into a stock picker's market right now. But even in that monolithic, you know, quantitative forever, easing forever environment, you had energy stocks that peaked in 2014, 2015. They peaked again in 2019, 2020. And so industry group analysis really helps you even in a monolithic market where there is a lot of correlation. But I do think we're heading into a stock picker's market right now for a whole series of reasons having to do with the mega caps likely to underperform and, you know, some group rotation that's going to take place on the upside. I started talking in, I'd say it was February of 2021, about a series of rolling crashes that we would have. It started with the tech stocks peaking and the ARK fund peaking, and then it just kept spilling over to various sectors and industry groups. I think we're going to see that in reverse now. We already have seen some of that, where you're going to see some earnings reports and macroeconomic factors drive rolling bull markets in a whole variety of sectors and industry groups. But at the end of the day, I think we're in a stock picker's market.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
So I want to push a little bit on that stock picker's market wording. And is it really stock pickers or is it sector pickers? And I say that because there's a lot of studies, as you know, that show that, you know, the vast majority of variability is driven by asset allocation. I always use that line that to beat the average, you have to choose the right average, right? It's less about the constituents, right? It's more about the school of fish, right? Sort of analogy. Is it really about the stock side or is it more just about group movement, which ties into relative strength?
No, I really think it is. Well, relative strength is a sort of way to differentiate between, let's say, a restaurant stock that's going to go up 30% and a restaurant stock that's going to go up 200%. So, you know, and that's a combination of fundamentals and technicals. So in any industry group, there's always the best of the best. There's a particular ETF group that I think has a really good quantitative model. I don't know if it's fair game to mention it, so I won't until you get, unless you give me the green light.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, First Trust. Full disclosure, we did some unit investment trusts for them in 2015, but we haven't had a relationship with them since 2017. They have a quantitative model that is a little bit similar to the Chaikin Power Gauge. You look at the First Trust ETFs and drill down into the stocks in their top performing ETFs, and you've got a buy list on your hands of stocks that you can buy. They just have a good model. And when you're looking at one of their sector or industry ETFs that's performing well, you're going to find winning stocks in that portfolio. They've got a model that sort of filters out the losers, which is what the Chaikin Power Gauge does.
Talk about that journey of starting Chaikin Analytics and building out the technology, building out the branding, the marketing. I mean, it's easy for people to just go to a website and see it all there, but presumably there's a hell of a lot of work that went into everything that goes on the front end.
Oh, big time. The genesis of it is sort of interesting. I retired from Reuters and Instinet in 1998 after 6 years of building an institutional workstation business for them. We had something like 15,000 seats competing with Bloomberg and Reuters and Bridge Data. And that enabled me to sort of take some time off. And what I thought was going to be a one-year sabbatical ended up to be a 10-year retirement. I moved up to Connecticut to my weekend house, gave up New York City happily at that time. And then 2008 came along, and my wife, who was in marketing and was still working at a 401k plan that was being run by an advisor, and it got decimated, as everybody's portfolio did in 2008 into 2009. And she said, there's got to be a better way. I'm paying 1% to lose 50%. She said, that doesn't make sense to me. So I said, you know what? There is a better way. I'll come out of retirement and fulfill my life's dream, which is to build a model that's fundamental, not technical. And so I spent about a year and a half building the Chaikin Power Gauge rating, backtesting on data back to 1998, which was 10 years of data, which was readily available at the time. And we launched the model in 2011, in January, in the form of research reports on 5,000 U.S. equities based on the power gauge. And I was fortunate that people knew me from the Chaikin money flow. Stockcharts.com had always featured it in their ads. And so we had some brand recognition. And my wife sort of knew a little bit about marketing, not about the stock market. But that was the start of it. But it took a long time to build the brand. We started out with an iPhone app, which it shows you how technology and business don't always mesh. I thought if you build it, they'll come. And so we launched an iPhone app in 2011 based on the power gauge. And we got something like 40,000 downloads in the first 3 months. They had something back then called New and Noteworthy in the App Store. Well, guess what? We didn't capture email addresses because some smart marketing guy said, well, if you ask for an email address, then you'll cut down your downloads by 60 or 70%. So we had no way to monetize. So here we had built a fabulous mousetrap and nobody was paying us for it. So slowly we shifted over to a subscription model, and over a 5 year period, we built a really strong following for our iPad app and then a desktop workstation. And then 2 years ago, we sold the company to what's now called MarketWise, which is Stansberry Research is part of MarketWise. And we decided, I decided really with my investors' encouragement, because we had a lot of angel investors, to try and reach as broad an audience as possible with the power gauge. Because, it was my life's work. It's why I came out of retirement, and to only have 5,000 people subscribing seemed nice, but I thought we could really help people more. And in fact, over the last 12 months, that has really been the case, because I turned bearish on the market in mid to late January of 2022. So since we've been at Stansberry and benefited from their unique style of marketing, we've really broadened our reach, and a lot of people see our subscriptions and also our free daily email called Chaikin Power Feed, which goes out to an obscene number of people who've signed up for it every day, with market commentary from a staff of 4 very experienced fundamental and technical analysts, and then some valuable content that's computer generated. So it's been a great journey for me, as I said, it's a culmination of a life's career. Someone said, "When are you going to retire?" Trading is my life. I'm not going to retire. It's what I do.
I'm curious. Have you typically seen a pickup in interest in subscribers in bear markets, in bull markets, at inflection points? The reason I'm asking that is, I know the guys at the CMT Association fairly well, and they've always made it a point that they tend to see the most number of people taking the CMT level one exam in a bear market, right? Because suddenly risk management is sort of, in vogue. Any kind of interesting insights as far as subscriber interest and where we are in the cycle?
That's always been the case in my business career. When we launched what was the Bomar terminal in 1987, institutional investors who normally wouldn't have given you the time of day because they were doing pretty well were looking for an answer. So they would take the meeting. I think that's true with CMT. And that's, as I mentioned earlier, that was the genesis of my diving into technical research. 1969, 1970, it was just brutal if you weren't using some sort of risk management based on technical analysis, because stop losses don't do it for me. But I'd say that our subscribers tend to be self-directed investors, the kind of people who would probably listen to this podcast. And we saw a pretty consistent interest all through 2022 because we were calling it like it is. I was bearish. My team was bearish. We saw these rolling corrections and it resonated with people. We helped get people out of stocks like Peloton, Zoom, and Beyond Meat and Shake Shack and so forth. And it sort of seeped through. People got it. The old concept that in a bear market, people don't open their drawer and look at their monthly statements, I think is a myth. It was true sometimes in the 70s, 73, 4, or maybe in the aughts, but people are pretty up on what's going on, right? This 24/7 news cycle in the stock market as well as in the political spectrum. And I think people know what's going on and they are looking for answers.
Everybody, please make sure you follow Mark Chaykin. Check out ChaykinAnalytics.com. Again, I will have this as a podcast on all your favorite platforms. I think the question everyone is wondering is, are these series of rolling corrections over? Now, I'll preface this by saying they're over for now. They're over until they're not over. I myself have been on this kind of kick that we're in this melt-up environment. Conditions are there for continuation higher. A lot of people last year have been conditioned to be bearish because one of the very unusual dynamics of last year, Mark, as you know, is that you had a staircase down as opposed to the elevator down. In other words, the number of weeks the S&P lost money was unusually consistent relative to other historical periods. So a lot of recency bias, right, in terms of just the psychology end. Do you think that the bear market is over, or is this one of those classic, with hindsight, bear market rallies?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
I'm 100% of the belief that the bear market is over. And I can go into some of the sort of simple ways that people can sort of validate that viewpoint. But I was in the camp after the October bottom that rally, which died in early December, was a bear market rally, and we would come back down and make lower lows. And the reason was I thought there would be an earnings recession and that estimates were too high. I was sort of in the Mike Wilson camp from Morgan Stanley. But I also recognized that the election year pattern and seasonality were very bullish starting in October. So typically in a midterm election year, the market bottoms out in the fourth quarter. And then you see a pretty sharp rally off that low. So I was looking for something to tell me to change my opinion. And that something happened on January 13th when we got the infamous breakaway breadth thrust that either Walter Diemer and or Marty Zweig first identified 40 years ago. And that breadth thrust is pretty simple. 2-to-1, 10-day advanced decline ratio, New York Stock Exchange. Some people shave it to 1.8. That's probably front-running it. Two-thirds of the time, that works. One-third of the time, you come back down. But 2.0, meaning twice as many advances versus declines over a 10-day period, has happened 18 times prior to January 13th. And in each of the 18 instances, marked the end of a confirmation that the bear market had ended. So I put out a special report. I write a monthly market letter as part of our subscription service called Chaikin Market Insights. And the January, it's published the second Monday of every month, the January 9th issue, I was bearish, looking for a lower low. But then when this breadth thrust triggered on January 13th, I put out a special alert issue on January 17th, the day after Martin Luther King Day, saying that the market has spoken and I don't think there's going to be a lower low. So subsequent events, I was looking for three things to happen to confirm that, and they've all happened since January 17th. So I'm, you know, unless it's different this time, going back to 1950, this has been flawless. And I'll refer the listeners to something that John Templeton said from Franklin Templeton Funds. He said, the most costly words in the investment world are, this time it's different. Because human nature doesn't change. The stock market, basically the ebbs and flow of the stock market are very often a function of human nature, of, you know, fear and greed playing out in the marketplace. And, you know, when you sort of break through that level that we did on January 13th in terms of the breadth thrust, it's pretty powerful.
Yeah, and for whatever it's worth, that was around the time that lumber started surging. Granted, it's now done a round-trip move. The home builders are still strong, so who knows, you know, how that plays out. Utilities started weakening. Like, you know, you saw it to start the year after that first week, a almost tectonic rotation, even from a relative strength perspective. You know, discretionary, as you noted, staples weakness, discretionary strength. So, you know, we'll see. I myself am of the mindset that I think there's a credit event out there only because you've got a lot of loans that are maturing next year, which we can touch on as sort of a potential risk. But let's go to...
So Paws has had fabulous accumulation, Chaikin money flow, and it started outperforming the market. And this is where relative strength comes in mid-January. Our relative strength indicator, I use it, heat map of relative strength. It's like a stochastic of relative strength. It's a 6-month stochastic of relative strength, and it gives you a little lead. And that turned bullish on January 13th, with Paws trading at 51.84, and Chaikin money flow was very strong. Our power gauge rating turned bullish on February 6th. So yeah, I think Paws is an interesting ETF. Not a lot of asset. Well, actually, that's $331 million in assets. That's a lot. Doesn't trade, though. Well, their index IQs ETFs from New York Life Investment Management. And what I did was create three indices for NASDAQ, large cap, small cap, and dividend achievers. And the large cap and the small cap ETF each have about $300 million in them, but we don't have an active role in the management. We just create the NASDAQ Chaikin large cap index and the NASDAQ Chaikin small cap, which uses the power gauge as an overlay. So it basically filters out the bearish stocks and in those two universes. And yeah, I think the ETF market is great for someone who wants to participate and not manage their investments. I've always been a believer in active management. As Michael said, it's really tough, particularly from 2016 on through 2020, to beat the averages unless you are concentrated in six stocks or five stocks. So active fund managers have, you know, really took a beating unless they sort of overweight stocks, which is not what they're being paid to do. But if, for someone who wants to participate, I think ETFs are great. And as I said, if you just have a little bit of an edge, which is for me right now would be equal weighted S&P, equal weighted consumer discretionary instead of cap weighted, you can really do just fine. I've just always been a stock picker. I'll give you an anecdote, which I always chuckle about it. I was working, I only had one real job in my life. I worked for a commercial factor in New York City, and factors to this day lend money to garment center businesses based on receivables. And the two best things about that job is A, I learned how to read a balance sheet, and B, I learned about the stock market because all of the executives of this factoring firm were trading like the devil in, you know, in the mid 60s, particularly apparel companies that they knew for, through business. But then I decided I want to get into the stock market, and Shearson Hamel was advertising for stockbrokers, and you had to take sort of psychological test to see if you were suited for sales. And I met with the sales manager of the main office, and he said, now, you're not one of those young hotshots who's going to come in here and try and pick your own stocks and ignore the firm's research. I said, oh, no, I don't want to do that. I just want to sell. And it was total fiction. All I wanted to do was pick stocks. That just that was my life's dream, to find winners. So to this day, I think stock picking is the way to outperform the market. And, you know, if you don't want to do that work, and something like the power gauge or any other model that's out there that someone believes in, you know, could plug in and solve that equation. But if you're willing to put in a little bit of extra work, and it doesn't have to be more than an hour on the weekends. My wife, Sandy, is the reason we started the company, has become a great stock picker, just using the power gauge and a little bit of technical analysis that's built into our system. And part of the reason is she doesn't bring any baggage. You know, she was a mutual fund investor. She happened to pick great funds, Peter Lynch's Magellan Fund and Bill Miller's Legg Mason Value Fund. But since we built the power gauge, she's been managing our retirement, and she's doing a great job of picking stocks, again, because she doesn't bring a lot of baggage to the table.
I want to continue on this point around market cap for a second here. It's amazing to me, the if you were to look at the ratio of the Russell 2000 divided by the S&P 500, just small divided by large, you're basically back to the start of the inception of the Russell 2000. It's like 1987 relative levels, meaning since 87, small caps have had the same performance as large caps, with a lot more volatility. And a lot of that, to your point, a lot of that underperformance, it was actually around, I think it was first quarter of 2014, where small to large started really weakening. And that's when kind of FANG momentum really started to take place. I hear you on the stock pickers market. Do you think that this is a multi-year dynamic where you're going to see better breadth? Because I think part of the argument that you would not see that breath continue is the resurgence of tech again, because there's a direct link between market cap weighting and the technology sector's leadership.
Well, I think the tech leadership may fade a bit. I think there was an enormous amount of short covering from the hedge funds in the first 6 weeks of this year. And part of what you just described is the small cap, but part of it is value versus growth, as you know. And one of the interesting things about this breadth momentum signal, and also there was a signal on XLY versus XLP about 2 weeks ago. It was picked up by, I think, Sentiment Trader, which is a great service, Jason Gottfried. And XLY just spiked relative to XLP. And historically, that's been very bullish for small and mid-cap stocks and value stocks. So I do think it's going to continue. And I think I'm not a big fan of mega cap stocks. I think Amazon's, I think, had its day in the sun, no longer belongs in a forever portfolio, if such a thing exists. And, you know, I'm a little edgy about Microsoft, that's jumped up on the AI mania. So I don't think large caps. Google is obviously, Alphabet's having its problems, at least in the short run. But I do think that small cap tech, we've had some real success with smaller cap semiconductors in the last 2 months. A couple of stocks that we identified early on have doubled. So I think tech to me is okay, not particularly if you're in small cap. But I do think that this whole small and mid and value versus growth is swinging that way and will be that way for quite a bit of time.
I wonder if that dovetails a little bit international investing, because a lot of emerging markets have a more value tilt, just given the sector makeup. Do you think there's sort of is there a connection there with international investing versus, you know, U.S. being the only game in town?
Well, clearly EEM has been the place to be for the last 6 months. I'm sort of a Luddite, Michael, when it comes to that. My theory has always been, if you can't make money finding good stocks in the U.S., then you shouldn't be in the game. And I'm not, I shouldn't say it this way, I'm not sophisticated enough to tread into the, certainly into the emerging market universe. We have power gauge ratings on ADRs that trade. And so that gives us some broad exposure in terms of individual stocks to China and Europe and so forth. But I've never been a big proponent of emerging markets just because information is sketchy in those markets. But certainly in the ETF world, you can take advantage of it without a lot of single stock or event risk. Well, Apple is it's like a Swiss Army knife. Whatever your style, you can justify being an Apple. So growth value, doesn't matter. You know, and Bill Miller did. Remember when Bill Miller took a huge position in Apple and it was totally against his value props. So, hey, Apple is a money machine. And they, you know, they buy back stock. It's still got an enormous, obviously, price to sales ratio, something like 7x, which is pretty high in this market environment. I think these stocks are no longer appropriate as core holdings. Amazon more so than Apple, but you know, Steve Jobs said something interesting. You know, I'm not doing this for now. I'm doing this to build a cash machine, and Tim Cook has done a really great job of milking that cash cow. But Amazon's a totally different story. Just to segue a little bit, I'll get back to Apple if you like. In 2018, Jeff Bezos addressed the Amazon employees. And he said, Amazon's going to go bankrupt someday. Every retail enterprise in America has gone bankrupt. Every big one. Montgomery Ward, Sears, Kresge, you name it. They all went bankrupt. He said, our job is to keep it afloat as long as possible. And he did a great job of that. But I think Amazon has seen its day in the sun. And it was actually my bearish stock of the year, starting in November. And then I segued to a different stock. But I think Amazon is at serious risk of PE compression. And depending on what AWS looks like going forward in terms of cloud computing growth, you know, they're not really making money on their retail business. They're making money on AWS. They're making money on Amazon Prime. They're making money on private brands, which has now come under scrutiny. You know, the fact that they know more about what you and I want than we know ourselves. So they sort of focus their private brand, private label business on where they can get the biggest bang for the buck. Well, guess what? The government's taking offense. So, you know, I think Amazon's got some serious issues going forward. Is it going to go bankrupt? Of course not, or probably not. But I don't think it belongs in a core portfolio right now. I think, you know, there's some benchmarks that you need to use to guide you. If you just go back to the August peak, forget the peak in early 2022, the August peak on Apple is around 174, trading here at 153, where you've got a lot of other tech stocks making new highs. So is it a place that I'd want to have growth money right now? No. Is it a place where I'd want to have dividend money? No, because, you know, their dividend yield is less than 1%. So, you know, unless you're a diehard Apple aficionado, I don't see a strong reason to be in Apple. You know, you could, I'm just going to drill down on my system into the tech hardware and storage. Well, there aren't that many tech hardware companies that have bullish ratings. And that's where Apple is bucketed by Standard & Poor's right now. I don't think it should be there, but they're just not with a lot of bullish ratings. If you are looking for tech, you're looking in the wrong place if you're focusing on Apple, in my view.
Other than large cap tech from a longer term perspective, any other major areas to avoid that, you know, are maybe old cycle leaders? I always go back to knowing what not to invest in is probably more important than knowing what to invest in.
Right. That's Herb Greenberg's mantra. And yep. I believe in that 1,000%. Herb's actually now part of the MarketWise team. So I had a chance to interact with him recently over the last 6 to 12 months. It's the stocks you don't own that matter. And I think if you want to know what to own, just drill down on the ARK portfolio and there it is. You don't want to be in any of those stocks or in most of those stocks. So if you go into ARKK, and interestingly, at the peak in February 2021, not one stock in our ARKK had a bullish rating in power gauge, shaken power gauge. So if you look at their largest holdings, it's a poster child for what to avoid: Robinhood, Roku, Zoom. Those are the neutral stocks: Bearish, Beam, CRISPR, Novida, Roblox. These are just not where you should be. Square, Twilio, Shop, DraftKings particularly shouldn't be there, in my view. Coinbase. You know, so I agree with you that the old cycle leaders are not, and they never have been. There's rarely a market cycle where the leadership hasn't shifted.
I think that's a good place to wrap this Twitter space up. Again, everybody, please make sure you follow Mark Chaykin. Check out Chaykin Analytics. This podcast will be on all your favorite platforms. Thank you, everybody, for joining. Thank you, Mark. Really do appreciate your knowledge, experience, and the way you communicate here.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at LeadLag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the LeadLag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.